The first incident was by a virus. The virus called Stuxnet attacked control units for centrifuges at Natanz, causing the sensitive devices to spin out of control and destroy themselves. Experts widely believe the attack was carried out by America and Israel, as does Iran. Natanz is ground zero for cyber war. It's the place where the world's first real cyber attack took place a decade ago. The joint U.S.-Israel operation.
Israeli authorities are afraid of Iran becoming a nuclear power in a peaceful manner. That's why they are committing different kinds of sabotage acts. Again, I'm repeating, during these times of negotiations, they are not willing Iran to become a party of 4+1 group. That's why they are trying to prevent Iran from getting a compromise, from reaching a compromise with its own, parties.
The thing with the recent, that Sunday the 11th April attack on Natanz, is that it's not just Reuters anymore, but more and more reports pointing towards an explosion at the power supply rather than simply a cyber attack. Going by precedence, however, whatever the reason, it should only be a temporary setback for Iran's nuclear program. Still, even a simple blackout is not harmless at a nuclear site. Centrifuges are slender machines linked up in cascades which enrich uranium gas by spinning it at incredibly high speeds using rotors. The stress on the advanced materials involved is intense, and the process is technically immensely challenging. A small problem can send a centrifuge spinning out of control, with parts smashing into each other and damaging a whole cascade. I asked our experts how they predicted the outcome of the Vienna talks.
It's not unlikely that the U.S. would take a serious stance about lifting sanctions, considering the rise of tensions in the U.S.-Russia relations on the one hand, and the tensions between Washington and Beijing on the other, and the U.S. effort to counter China and Russia. So it has become more likely for them to seek an agreement with Iran. That being said, the parties who are opposed to JCPOA have adopted destructive policies that could affect the process of the agreement's revival. Israel's terrorist activities are part of that.
P4 JCPOA member state China is aware of the situation. Wang Kun, its head of delegation to Vienna, called for a faster pace and fewer distractions. Western parties can't not have been secretly pleased to see Iran's hand weakened, to see this country stripped of its leverage, its nuclear advancement, that is. Thing is, Iran never was stripped of anything. It's just picking up its nuclear program where it left off. And even without that, in attending the Vienna talks, it never meant to resurrect the deal at any cost. The idea was the U.S. will lift all sanctions in a single stroke. Only then will Iran scale back its nuclear enrichment levels in re-compliance with the nuclear deal, and only after verifying that sanctions have really been lifted. That can take 6 months.
The reason why the U.S. didn't represent at the negotiating table was that it was Iran's demand that the U.S. Rob Mali should not be a representative of 4+1 at the negotiating table. It was Iranian request, and it was a great, achievement for Iranian negotiators at the negotiating table. So, in my opinion, we must persist on our own demands. We should not get back. We should just move forward, insist on our request, insist on our demands to remove all sanctions at the same time, completely, without any precondition. And after that, there should be a safeguarding, agreements between Iran and 4+1 or 5+1. Because in future, if Israel commit this kind of acts, we have to have a mechanism in order to respond to this Israeli act of sabotage.
You see, the attack on the Natanz nuclear facility a few months back and the recent attempt show there is a security gap in Iran that the Israelis can exploit and infiltrate to assassinate Iranian nuclear scientists and damage nuclear facilities. Well, this is a negative point. But the other point that should be noted about Iran's nuclear program is that it has become indigenous. Israel cannot be more wrong to think that an attack on a nuclear facility could hinder Iran's efforts and prolong the Vienna talks or even result in the JCPOA's demise. But that didn't happen.
Sabotage and crime stretched over a decade, all leaving behind a trail of Israeli footprints. Here's the sum of lives lost. 5 scientists in 10 years, plus in some cases their companions. By end November 2020, at least 4 nuclear scientists had been killed in vehicle bombings and shootouts, and several others had been targeted but survived. Those killed with martyr status are Masoud Ali Mohammadi, Majid Shahriari, Dariush Rezai Nejad, Mostafa Ahmadi Roshan, and most recently on the 27th of November 2020, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. Both the US and Israel denied involvement. Fereydoun Abbasi was wounded end 2010, but he survived after being rushed to hospital. The most recent sabotage of the nuclear program followed Iran's unveiling of its nuclear achievements, which are of great use for medical purposes, say making medicine. The unveiling happened on National Nuclear Technology Day, April the 10th, 2021. Saturday, April the 10th, saw an exhibition of 133 technological innovations with civilian and medical uses. In Isfahan's Natanz alone, the order was given to feed gas to 164 all-Iranian IR-6 centrifuges, slated to be mass-produced on an industrial level. Also, mechanical tests began on the top-of-the-line IR-9 centrifuge that has a separative capacity of 50 SWU. And a unit to assemble and evaluate advanced centrifuges was launched. There, the presenting engineer said, more than half of all operations are currently industrialized. Natanz, where the country's largest nuclear facilities are located, is in central Iran. 3 major nuclear sites apart from Natanz are the Arak Heavy Water Reactor Facility, Bushehr Nuclear Power Plant, and Fordo Enrichment Site. Ill will surrounds JCPOA talks, even by some Arab neighbors. Although, according to insiders, technical talks would continue at the expert level in the areas of sanctions and nuclear enrichment. Also, bilateral meetings would continue on the sidelines.
Iran's antagonists, regimes like Saudi Arabia and Israel, they're facing major problems. We see in Yemen that the Saudis are being badly defeated alongside the Emirates. And when their overlords, the Americans and the Europeans, are having their own problems, that basically means that Iran's influence rises, the influence of Iran's allies rise. So if the Americans want to continue hostility with Iran and to continue with heightened tensions, then they're going to have to spend more trillions of dollars in this region at a time when they cannot compete with the Chinese.
Apparently, parties have come to a considerable understanding, finally. As of Monday, April the 19th, here's what was tweeted by Mikhail Ulyanov. That's Russia's permanent representative to organizations in Vienna. Summing up the results of 2 weeks of deliberations on JCPOA restoration, we can note with satisfaction that the negotiations entered the drafting stage. Practical solutions are still far away, but we have moved from general words to agreeing on specific steps towards the goal. That's it for today, but there's plenty more to follow, so do return to the box at the same times next week and each week after. From me and the whole team, bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
the month of God. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, salam and welcome to the program. We are with you with another episode of the special series for Ramadan. On the 10th day of Ramadan, the loyal and unmatched wife of the Prophet of Islam, Lady Khadija, passed away. During the pre-Islam era, she used to be called Tahire, meaning spotlessly pure, as she was very chaste and pious. She was known as the master of the women of Quraysh tribe. She was also famous as a very wise and foresighted lady among the Arab people. Lady Khadija was very rich, hence she was also called as Malikat al-Arab, or the Queen of Arabs. Some of the researchers maintain that she had got married before marriage with Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. But others, like Ja'far Murtaza Ameli, are of the opinion that the Prophet of Islam was the first and only husband of Lady Khadija, peace upon her. This great lady was a refuge for the needy and the destitute even before Islam. Lady Khadija generously put her entire wealth at the service of the Prophet and the cause of Islam. The Prophet described her, saying, "Khadija believed in me when others denied me, and accepted me when others rejected me, and rushed to help me with her wealth when others deprived me, and God granted me children through her that He didn't grant me through any of other wives." Lady Khadija was very kind toward the Prophet. When the Prophet entered the house, she would welcome him and sympathize with him. She would dust his face and tell him soothing words to alleviate the hardships that he had sustained from the polytheist. Ibn Ishaq, the first writer of the history of Islam, writes, "The Prophet would not hear any denial or saddening word from the disbelievers unless Lady Khadija would alleviate it. She would accept him and consider the insults of people as unimportant." All of us know that lying is one of the worst sins and is the source of many other sins. This sin deprives us from the divine mercy in this world and the hereafter. Lying also causes people not to trust us. According to the Islamic narrations, lying is the key to other sins. Imam Ali, peace upon him, says, "Telling truth is invitation to doing righteous deeds, and doing righteous deeds is invitation to paradise." The 11th successor of the Prophet, Imam Hassan Askari, peace upon him, also says, "All evils have been put in a room, and the key to that room is lie." One of the things that nullify fasting is to attribute lie to God, the Prophet, and the infallible Imams. It includes verbal attribution or written one. In view of this, a fasting person cannot narrate the statements from the Prophet and the Imams unless he or she is sure of the narration to be correct. This will nullify his or her fasting. The Prophet of Islam and the Imams of East Ahlul Bayt have highly recommended us to be optimistic at the time of praying. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, says, "Pray to God in a way that you are certain about its fulfillment." Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, also says, "When you pray, at that moment, think that your need has been met and is ready." Now let us continue reciting another part of Dua Abu Hamza Somali. As we said in the previous episode, this application was taught to Abu Hamza by the fourth infallible successor of the Prophet, Imam Sajjad, peace upon him. "My Lord, had anyone known my sin except you, I would have not committed it, and had I feared hasty punishment, I would have refrained from it. Not because you are the meanest of seers, but because you are the best coverer and highest ruler and noblest of the noble. Where is your beautiful covering? Where is your great pardoning? Where is your near release? Where is your quick response to refugees? Where is your vast mercy? Where are your gracious bounties? Where are your sweet blessings? Where are your ample affair? Where is your great grace? Where is your corpulent bounty? Where is your old goodness? Where is your nobility, O noble? By your nobility, save me, O giver of bounties. I'm not the one to rely on my deeds to be saved from your punishment. Thy rely on your grace upon us, because you are the giver of bounties and pardon sins nobly. So we do not know what to thank, whether the beauty that you have spread or the ugliness that you have covered. O friend of anyone who befriends you, an apple of eyes of anyone who takes refuge with you and cuts other bonds for your sake. My Lord, is it possible to see you doing against our optimistic wishes in you or frustrate our hopes in you? Never, O noble, my Lord. We disobeyed you while we hope that you will cover our sin. We called you while we hope that you will answer us and fulfill our hope. O guardian, indeed we know that we do not deserve it with our deeds, but we know that you will not expel us from your door, although we are not entitled to your mercy. But you are such that you forgive us, O forgiver. By your light we were guided, and by your grace we were became needless. And with your bounty we spend our day and night. Our sins are before you. O God, we seek forgiveness for them and return to you."
Debate. Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marcia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, the motto of France is freedom, liberty, and fraternity. Many French would say that there is a major gap in the slogan of the country and reality on the ground for its people. This as the French National Assembly has passed a new security law giving police even more power. One of the most controversial parts of the law prohibits the sharing of images of police with malicious intent. Now, critics say it is vague and can be used to stifle freedom and initiate a more severe crackdown. We're going to start off this discussion crossing over to Paris, joined by correspondent there, Chris DeHaan. Chris, well, fill us in on what this law could mean.
Well, concretely, this law means certainly a limitation of individual and public liberties. So the police impunity will increase, that's for sure. Police powers are increasing, that's for sure. Now it will be interesting to investigate the exact degree of the limitation of these freedoms, because France is still not a police state. There are still democratic institutions functioning, political parties, associations, trade unions are working, but it's not sure in what kind of degree, demonstrations, for instance, will be allowed in the near future. So it's certainly a limitation of public liberties, but we are not yet in a dictatorship.
And let me get our next guest in, too, on this independent journalist, if I have him out of Marseille, Sylvain Marcadia. Your take on this. In your opinion, why has the Macron government pushed for this? They were very aggressive in wanting to make sure this legislation gets passed.
Yes, it's a good question. Like, I really believe that the the party in power, Macron's party, La République En Marche, is trying to attract voters who would vote for the far-right party, Rassemblement National, headed by Marine Le Pen. So this move that is basically supporting the actions of the police, supporting the impunity of the police, is a move to attract these conservative votes in favor of Macron for the coming elections next year. So I do believe that this is one of the objectives. The other is also to reassure the police in a moment where it is becoming like a key element of the French institutions. Like the public opinion is more and more engaged against the government. We've seen the Yellow Vest movement erupting a few years ago, a few months after Macron was elected and after his first policies. And this is a way to support, reassure the police in their actions against these movements that are opposing the power, the party in power, I believe.
Okay, let me welcome my next guest out of Paris, journalist and geopolitical analyst, Gerard Coleman. Gerard, good to have you with us. Your take on exactly what this means now. I mean, has France transitioned? Is it leaning more and more to the right and just continually trying to limit individual freedom? Because we see this particular law, the security law. We also have seen the separation law. Your assessment of what is going on in general in the country?
Well, it's been leaning to financial rights since the 1960s, really when the Rothschild Bank took over, particularly in the 1970s. So the trajectory of French politics from the late 60s to now has been towards the extreme financial rights. Socially, in terms of social mores, the regime in place is essentially a consequence of 1968. So that's what goes for the left today. I don't really know what you would call that in terms of right or left. But I think the reality is that we have a police state, and now they're giving police full powers. So we have a situation where drones, for example, can go into people's houses. Police can use drones. They did use them in the lockdown last year. They used drones in different parts of the country, but that caused controversy. I mean, it was a lot of people were opposed to the idea of being followed around by drones, police drones. Now it will give police those kind of powers. We did see massive police brutality and repression during the Yellow Vest uprisings. We've seen massive police brutality right throughout the lockdown period over the last year. Just the other day in Paris, people were hunted out of parks and hunted out of the Seine area where people used to have picnics. People are not allowed to live effectively anymore in France, and that's not an exception, that's all over Europe. It is illegal to meet people, it is illegal pretty much to do anything other than go to work, wear a mask and so on and come home. So what it means is that it basically gives the police now the possibility of following you around with a drone, openly surveilling the whole population. And also, you know, private life is gone. They can legally go into your home. They have some suspicion about you. Now, suspicion about you might be that you're not wearing a mask in your home if they make that the next law, which they could. And because they're pretty much most of the time now here, when you read the newspapers, every day a new law is being passed which takes away some other fundamental human liberty. So they spend most of their time discussing what liberty they're going to take away next. And so if you were to look at Paris now, particularly since the attacks in 2015-16, the series of terrorist attacks, it's police state, there's police everywhere. And, you know, if you compare it to so-called totalitarian countries, let's say like Iran, and I've been there many times, you don't see the same police concentration in the streets. This is a police state, and of the police. If you ask here about the mask issue, for example, wearing masks in the street in Paris, I mean, some people believe in that and they comply, but a lot of people don't like being forced to do things. And most people I've spoken to said they wear them because they fear the police. Mm-hmm. So that you have a situation where people live in fear of police all the time. Generally, the population in France is really very, very sick of fines. They get fined for living here.
Okay.
Speeding fines, with the sort of Internet of Things coming in, everything is being surveilled. So, you know, you've got sensors everywhere picking everything up. Now you're going to have biometric cameras. So, you know, that means essentially you're under surveillance all the time. And,
okay, stay with me, Gerard. Let me get Sylvain back in this discussion. Sylvain, you heard what Gerard was saying. Do you think that the majority of French people actually support these new security measures?
I don't think so. No, I really do not believe they do.
So why has the French Assembly? I mean, they're supposed to be representatives of the French people. So what has happened that this legislation then has been passed?
Well, this probably has to do with like the French particularity in politics, that even though politicians get like elected and voted for, they seldomly respect their promises once they get into power. Macron was never elected to vote these laws. Actually, there are many parts of his program that he never applied or delayed. And he has used the COVID-19 crisis very conveniently for this. And this is basically, yes, like the reason why the Assembly managed to vote this law. And I generally also believe that the establishment, the political establishment that voted this law is afraid, has learned the lessons from the Yellow Vest movement, feared for the stability of their well-being and everything, and they are ready to ensure that the status quo, like the Fifth Republic as we are we call our institutions, are going to be maintained. And that actually have many issues that should be discussed in order to eventually come out of this system that is very vertical in terms of power, gives a lot of power to the president, and amongst other many other issues. But The representative system of France has issues that should be addressed instead of giving more rights to repress demonstrators and people opposing the police, which is actually a fundamental right to demonstrate. That this is a right that's being denied little by little, as mentioned.
Okay, well, Gerard, where does the press fit in here? I mean, will they be able to show images from the scene of demos when police are involved, or where do you see things going from that perspective?
Well, the press is a system of state propaganda in all Western countries, and it's always been like that. So the press is the state, really. There isn't a separation. There is very little criticism allowed of state policy in the press. The press is there as a communication device of the state. So it's not going to affect the working of journalists, because they mostly publish fake news anyway. And the demonstrations that will be allowed, the demonstrations that will take place, will be demonstrations which are state-sponsored. So, for example, climate change demonstrations are given full support of the state, full support of the banks and the corporations. Gay pride is fully supported by the corporations and banks and the state. All these kinds of demonstrations will be promoted, but real demonstrations will not be allowed, and we're going to see a criminalization of the type of Gilets Jaunes protests, the anti-mask protests, the anti-forced vaccine protests. There haven't been many in France in comparison to other countries, but this will make it more difficult for people with real issues, real life issues, to demonstrate. And the press doesn't cover those issues anyway, so they're not going to be concerned about the repression of the real dissidents in the country. We've just seen a dissident released from prison today. Hervé Vessel was put in prison because of his writings, and so now we have political prisoners in France, and we have more prison sentences, prominent dissident intellectuals, and that's the future. They're actually emptying a lot of the prisons. They're letting prisoners, actual criminals, go, and they're filling them with political dissidents. And that is the future right now.
Well, Sylvain, now officials say that the law is needed to protect law enforcement officers. Your take on that side of things, what do you think?
I'll use a quote from David Dufresne, who is a French journalist who has been writing extensively on the Yellow Vest movement and on issues of global security in France and freedom of speech. And he was calling this law Orwellian, even in its name, global security. What security are we talking about? Are we talking about the security of the citizens, or are we talking about the security and impunity of the law enforcement forces? So, obviously, there is an issue with these laws, and they are definitely not to move in favor of freedom of speech. They are actually a deterrent for independent journalists to engage in their work and to document the actions of the police. The issue here is police brutality. The issue is not security of police officers. There have been so many cases of police violence documented by citizens in the streets, and this is what the police and Gérald Darmanin, the Ministry of Interior, are trying to go against with this law that is basically giving this impunity and preventing citizens of doing their work, which is to report police violence and other actions during demonstrations.
Well, Gerard, we've also witnessed so many different laws. One of them is the separation law in France, where Muslims have been the target. We're just seeing more and more and more laws that seem to be weeding away the rights of the people in France. I'm just wondering about the French people in general. The French people have more of a love for independence and individual freedom. Why aren't we seeing more of a reaction? We have seen some demonstrations, but do you think that we're going to see increased outward show of being upset to this new law by the French people, or have they just learned to acquiesce and accept it?
Well, there's two points there. You mentioned the Muslims and then the, you know, the French love of liberty. And I think, one, on the Muslim issue, the police in France are highly integrated with the Israeli Defense Forces, Mossad, the even Israeli militia like Betar, who are banned, are so extreme they're banned in Israel. They have links to French police. So that would explain focus as well on Muslims, because the constant obsession about Muslims in France, the danger and so on, and then many very suspect terrorist attacks, and of course a catastrophic foreign policy. None of that is ever discussed in the debate. So that, you know, that is that explains why you have repression of the Muslim community. But on the other issue of the general love of liberty, well, it's a farce. You know, Republican liberty has been a farce from the very start, because it's not based on any solid philosophy. It's based on a false theory of the human being, and it's based on 18th century Enlightenment ideas, which are false ideas, and we're seeing the consequence of that now. When you get that kind of republic, eventually you have to pass laws against every fundamental liberty. So it makes a farce of the whole idea of liberty in the first place. And so we're seeing the collapse, essentially, of the principles of the French Revolution. But in the context where those principles are becoming the principles of a global government system. So, you know, France is part of a much wider agenda here. Europe, the world, is going through the same process. There is a specificity in France, of course, which is the French love of liberty. But the we haven't seen any manifestation of that in the last year. If you compare France, for example, to Germany, millions of people demonstrated against the lockdown in Germany. They demonstrated against the pseudoscience promoted by the media and so on and so forth. There's been very little of that in France. So I think...
Why is that the case?
One of the reasons, I would say, is that the French were simply worn out from demonstrating with the Yellow Vest. I mean, you had the Yellow Vest movement just galvanized, it just, you know, mobilized thousands of people for, 2 years? It just went on and on and on and on. It went nowhere. And in a way, I think it sort of it exhausted an awful lot of people. And then after that, with the coronavirus, they were kind of taken by surprise. But I also think it's the French are very brilliant media propagandists, and they have a much more sophisticated propaganda system than any other country I know. They are very good at preempting counter arguments and preempting counter movements. They do it better than most of the countries. And in the last year, you compare the Anglophone media to the French media. French have been very good at sort of at basically dividing and conquering the French elites, that is. And I think that's one of the reasons they basically, you know, you have a far-right party, sort of a far-right party, which is in bed with the Zionists, has not really had, you know, made any significant opposition to the Macron regime in the last year. Could have had many opportunities to come out and be the hero of the people, open everything up and put the bad guys in jail. Marine Le Pen is completely sold out. And we're seeing that with a lot of the far-right parties in Europe, so-called far-right parties, that they are basically going along with the technocratic agenda. And they're not coming out on the side of the people. So that's another reason that you have extreme manipulation on the right and on the left here. And, you know, that there is no coherent view of opposition that can unite the opposition to put an end to this. Because you have to see that a lot of these agendas are linked. You know, a police state giving police almost absolute powers, and then a lockdown situation, a medical dictatorship, forced vaccination, et cetera, et cetera. They're all linked. They're all part of the takeover of society by another. You know, we need to understand that that transcends class, race, and a lot of other issues that divide people. This is what is happening is that the wealthiest people in the world have taken over the world. They've taken over pretty much every state in the world. And, you know, France is an example of a country where they've done this to a very extreme extent, and they've managed to do it without much opposition until now. Because they have, they've been studying techniques of propaganda, I think, better than any other country.
Okay. And on that note, I'd like to thank My guests for being with us. We're out of time in this debate. Joining us in geopolitical analyst Gerald Coleman out of Paris and out of Marseille, independence journalist Sylvain Mercadia.
Thank you.
Thank you. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing off for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the all-compassionate, the all-merciful. Salam and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, which was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. We continue from where we left you last week, and here is Ayah 18 of Surah Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny.
فهل ينظرون إلا الساعة أن تأتيهم بغتة فقد جاء أشراطها فأنى لهم إذا جاءتهم ذكراهم.
Do they await anything except that the hour should overtake them suddenly? Certainly, its portents have come. Of what avail will be their admonition to them when it overtakes them? If you might recall, in our explanation of the preceding ayahs of this surah last Friday, we presented to you glimpses of the rewards reserved for the believers in paradise and the miserable fate of the disbelievers in hell. We also said, those receptive to the words of God acquire sincerity of heart, peace of mind, and positive behavior at home and in society, while the heedless ones, including those who do not contemplate when listening to the recitation of the Noble Quran, do not gain anything. Thus, the heavenly scriptures, with emphasis on monotheism, morally upright way of life, and the certainty of the day of resurrection for the final judgment, are the true guides for humanity rather than any man-made schools of thought. The ayah that we recited to you now refers to the disbelievers and the heedless ones, who, because of their lack of belief in the day of resurrection and judgment, waste their time and thus lose opportunities for repentance and reform, oblivious of the fact that the end could suddenly come before they could realize. The Arabic word sa'a in this ayah means the hour. and is usually used in the sense of resurrection. But it may also indicate divine wrath and annihilation of the disbelievers in this world as a prelude to the torments of resurrection for the deniers of truth. The next part of this ayah speaks of portents or signs of the coming of the fateful hour, when many could be caught unprepared. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, is reported to have said, "Should I inform you of the portents of resurrection? They are negligence in establishing the daily ritual prayers, following vain desires, cherishing the wealthy and exchanging religion for worldly possessions. As for those who say they won't believe in the Day of Judgment until they see it coming, these doubters could be likened to a patient who illogically questions the diagnosis of a physician and refuses to take the prescribed medicines by saying, 'I cannot believe my condition could lead to death until I see the approach of death.' Such an irrational person ought to realize that when death strikes, no medicine will be of any use. From this I will learn that, number one, disbelievers and deniers of the Day of Judgment waste the opportunities of respite that God has granted for repentance and self-reform because of their self-deception and intransigence. Number two, there are ample proofs and signs all around us in the world of nature of the certainty of the Day of Resurrection, but only the seekers of truth realize these facts without any negligence or wasting of opportunities." Now let us listen to ayah 19 of this surah.
فَعْلَمْ أَنَّهُ لَا إِلَهَ إِلَّا اللَّهُ وَاسْتَغْفِرْ لِذَنْبِكَ وَلِلْمُؤْمِنِينَ وَالْمُؤْمِنَاتِ وَاللَّهُ يَعْلَمُ مُتَقَلَّبَكُمْ وَمَثْوَاكُمْ.
Know that there is no God except Allah, and plead to Allah for forgiveness of your sin and for the faithful men and faithful women. And Allah knows how you move about and your abode. This ayah commands the steadfastness on the right path, since there is no God except Allah, the one and only Creator, whose protection we owe to seek and to whom we turn in earnest for forgiveness, without the least fear of the enemies. It stresses that whenever the believing men and believing women err or commit a fault, they should seek forgiveness from the All-Merciful. Even the prophets, who by nature are infallible and thus sinless, used to seek the forgiveness from the Lord Most High as a sign of their humbleness. It was the habit of the Prophet of Islam to beseech Allah for mercy and the forgiveness of the faults, sins, and shortcomings of the believers. According to a statement from the Prophet, among the best forms of devotion are recitation of the phrases, "Astaghfirullah" means, "I beseech Allah for forgiveness," and "La ilaha illallah," which means, "There is no God but Allah." Towards this end, the ayah means to say that nothing is hidden from the Almighty Creator, who is fully aware of all our movements and what we do in our abodes. This ayah teaches us the following points. Number one, the basis of all overworlds and deeds is monotheism, or the oneness of the Almighty Creator, rather than relying on fluctuating powers of fellow human or fearing them. Number two, the faithful men and women are included in the Prophet's supplications to the Lord Most High for forgiveness, as well as their health and purity of spirit. And number three, the Prophets and the Imams, though infallible by nature, are in need of divine favors. Now let us listen to Ayah 20 of Surah Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny.
ويقول الذين آمنوا لولا نزلت سورة فإذا أنزلت سورة محكمة وذكر فيها القتال رأيت الذين في قلوبهم مرض ينظرون إليك نظر المغشي عليه من الموت فأولى لهم.
Those who believe say, if only a surah were sent down for jihad, but when a definitive surah is sent down and fighting is mentioned in it, you see those in whose hearts is a sickness looking upon you with the look of someone fainting at death. So woe to them. This ayah refers to the tough conditions the Muslims face during the first few years of the advent of Islam, and means to say that because of persecutions by the Arab pagans, they would ask the Prophet whether a divine commandment for jihad had been revealed. But when a surah categorically and decisively commanded armed encounter to repel the aggressions of the disbelievers, some of these people, at the prospect of a battle, would become horrified and almost collapse out of fear. The true believers, however, would stand steadfast on the battlefield and fearlessly long for martyrdom, while the hypocrites who paid only lip service to Islam would be scared to death and run away. Thus, felicity lies in obedience to Almighty Allah, whose commandments ought to be carried out without the least fear. This ayah teaches us that, number one, there are many who make loud claims but retreat at the time of action. Number two, as the religion of mercy, Islam commands tough measures against the oppressors, including the armed fighting to repel their attacks. And number three, fear of defense against the enemies or fleeing the battlefield are signs of hypocrisy and lack of firm faith.